The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, are admonished to draw nigh and give their attention, for the Court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
Please be seated. Morning and welcome to the Fourth Circuit. We're prepared to hear argument on our first case, the United States versus Horton. Mr. Forehand, we'll be glad to hear from you.
May it please the Court, my name is Sam Forehand of Raleigh, North Carolina. I represent Timothy Horton, who is in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons at the United States Penitentiary at Pollock, Louisiana, following a conviction in the Eastern District of North Carolina for being a felon in possession of a .22 caliber rifle on the 10th of August, 2007, which the facts adduced at trial showed that he possessed during the course of a domestic dispute with his girlfriend at his girlfriend's house over his failure to disclose to her the identity of a female who had dialed his cell phone in her presence and her subsequent refusal to provide him transportation in her private automobile to some destination after that. The fact showed that he then went outside, fired a .22 caliber rifle into the air twice, discharged it also into her unoccupied vehicle, left the firearm at her residence, and left. He's serving a life sentence, however, because at sentencing, the district court applied a cross-reference for first-degree murder based on a robbery, home invasion, where a shooting occurred by shotgun 1 week later in a different part of Raleigh. The motive there was drugs and money. The facts that were adduced at the sentencing hearing showed it was gang-related, the domestic dispute having occurred in southeast Raleigh, the murder having occurred up in northeast Raleigh, or north Raleigh. The detective from Raleigh Police Department who testified at sentencing said that these were way far apart, not in the same part of town. So Mr. Horton this morning argues that this court and requests this court vacate his conviction for two reasons for the he requests the vacation of conviction. First, that the district court abused its discretion, rather, in denying his motion for substitute counsel that occurred 2 months prior to arraignment. Second, that the government failed to disclose impeachment evidence that was material to Mr. Horton's defense, particularly with respect to the confession to which two law enforcement officers testified, one in Mr. Horton's first trial, which resulted in a hung jury, and two officers who testified in his second trial, where he did obtain a conviction. With respect to that particular argument, he argues both that the materials should have been turned over, alternatively, that if the government knew that the agent had testified a year or so prior to trial that this homicide law enforcement was in fact investigating Mr. Horton for homicide, then the government had an affirmative duty to disclose to the court that when those two officers testified at Mr. Horton's trial that they were not conducting a homicide investigation, and that was the reason that they failed to record, or decided rather not to record.
What would that have done trial strategy that involved the motion in limine, which was in fact granted? Seems like to me that had you gotten the material that you are discussing now, that would have put a whole new wrinkle in the case that trial counsel was successful in keeping out.
It was part of a strategy. When trial counsel made that decision, trial counsel had no idea that the two law enforcement agents would change their testimony from the first trial to the second trial and testify at the second trial that the reason they did not record the custodial interrogation was because he was not a homicide suspect. When defense counsel wanted to keep the homicide investigation out, he would have had no idea that became not a shield but rather a sword. And also it was not true. So defense counsel could not have anticipated that the witness for the government, the law enforcement agents, would have gotten on the stand and use that very fact, sort of the opposite of, say, not just failing to reference a homicide investigation, but stating affirmatively to the jury that he was not a homicide suspect.
So are you saying the defense counsel then would have wanted to say to the jury, oh, actually, yes, he was a homicide suspect?
I think it becomes very important, Your Honor, that whether or not Mr. Horton confessed in this custodial interrogation in the Raleigh Police Department in February of 2008 was the fact on which this conviction turned, the verdict turned, rather. When the jury heard this case in June of the same year where the mistrial occurred in June and the retrial was in November, the same Detective Finelli, or Special Agent Finelli of the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, he testified that he didn't record the investigation because he'd just never done one in all his years and he didn't know how the equipment works. The jury hung. Had they believed that Special Agent Finelli, that confession did occur, then it would have been a guilty verdict. And so that fact is material, and defense should have been able to choose.
I guess what both Judge Agee's question and Judge Thacker's question are trying to explore with you is, can you take just 30 seconds and sketch out for us a scenario of how this so-called Brady would have been used consistent with the defense theory of the case? That's what I'm having difficulty.
I didn't try the case, Your Honor.
I understand that.
If it were me, in that moment, having to make that command decision when there's a witness saying something for the first time on the stand, I could have and may have decided to go ahead and disclose the existence of the homicide investigation as material impeachment that an agent of law enforcement had just stated something that is absolutely false based on police reports that report that law enforcement agent was, in fact, conducting photo lineups, talking to different witnesses who had fingered Mr. Horton as the shooter. It was a preference, strategic preference to be sure.
And I realize the difficulty my question put you in, because I'm asking you to surmise about what you would have done under a scenario that never existed in the real world. But I guess I'm having real difficulty understanding why you would, on the basis of a marginal improvement in impeachment, put before the jury your client's possible involvement in a homicide, to say nothing of a home invasion homicide, of a perfectly innocent woman, so far as the record shows. That seems to be, in other words, the cost-benefit here seems to be decidedly in favor of a finding of a lack of materiality.
I think the cost-benefit would be whether the jury would hear that there was an unrelated investigation going on, which the law enforcement had testified, that same agent said.
Right, that was already before the jury.
Not that the homicide investigation.
No, that there was an investigation going on.
Not for homicide,
great.
So the danger, had that come in, had we taken the course that I just said I might would have taken, would be that the jury would hear that there was an unrelated homicide investigation going on involving the defendant. There would have been no specific facts, it would have been vague references, and they would have... And that would have been a danger the defense would have risked, that the jury would have used for the bad man theory.
Well, you also would have risked redirect examination. Can you sketch that out for us?
Redirect the...
In other words, this, again, I realize the difficulty, but first of all, surely the agent would have known that you had that discovery. So again, the scenario that you're positing, I think, that... Everything else would have been the same, except you would have had the discovery and you would have been able to impeach. And I don't think that's a very realistic scenario to contemplate. The government would have turned it over. There wouldn't have been an alleged Brady violation. The government's witnesses would have known that it had been turned over. And indeed, the government would have prepared the witnesses for that cross-examination. I mean, don't we have to bring some rationality to this alternative reality?
Of course.
Okay.
Of course we have to bring rationality, Judge.
Okay.
But rationally, it is an important fact, this confession, whether this confession occurred would have been more important to the defense, showing the jury that this confession did not occur or that the law enforcement agents were bolstering it with facts that were absolutely ridiculous in order to convince them that it occurred, particularly where that same law enforcement agent was testifying with full recognition that last time he told this story and didn't say he failed to record it because of the homicide rule in North Carolina, but instead just didn't know how to work the equipment, the jury didn't believe him. So well, we would
I don't think you know whether the jury believed him or not. It may be that one juror didn't.
Right.
Or,
it could have been anything, but to that, neither did the witness know. And he knew that he gave one set of facts at the first testimony. This is the same witness, by the way, who the docket entries in this appeal show that the same U.S. Attorney's Office has subsequently indicted for making material false statements and witness tampering to influence the outcome of federal judicial proceedings in our district.
So he would not testify in a third trial.
I can't speculate, Your Honor.
You can speculate.
I'd love him to testify. We might call him. But we would have a choice.
I think so.
We would have to have a choice between whether you want the jury to hear, whether you want to argue whether the confession occurred that is directly relevant to this case, or whether the danger might exist that they would use some unrelated investigation, which the court would instruct them not to do, but nonetheless use it. We would have preferred to attack the confession, because that's what it turned on.
Counsel, you're running short on time. You may want to move to the sentencing issues.
Yes, sir. The cross-reference. Well, first of all, life is mandatory. Life is not mandatory under the guidelines. The district court operated with the belief and stated expressly that life was mandatory. That requires vacation. I think we go beyond that, though, to the cross-reference, and the cross-reference should not have applied because the conduct is not relevant. And in the order for supplemental briefing that this court issued, looking at the Pauley decision and the other decisions from the circuits that seem to have addressed this third, sixth, seventh, 11th, the best reading, the preferred reading of the grouping rule is that where the first-degree murder cross-reference just has to fall into the relevant conduct definition of 1B1.3, murder, robbery, violent crime, not subject to grouping. And that is a procedural trigger for the application of 1B1.3A2. And that is a good policy reason for that, because you're talking about broadening the scope of conduct that we would allow sentencing to consider. From those that occurred during the commission of offense or immediately before or thereafter and concealing it, to something that may have been more generally part of a common scheme, plan, that sort of thing. In some ways, it's a plain language argument. It's also a policy argument. And even the Third Circuit in the Janssen decision, and most of these decisions, by the way, were arguing drug cases. For whatever reason, these were coming up, the Wiss decision, the Gill decision, and Janssen even, we're arguing that in the case of a conviction for the substantive offense of possession with intent to distribute drugs, personal use drugs, simple possession, was not relevant. Some of the courts analyzed
it. If we were to agree with you on some form of the grouping argument, we wouldn't reach the issue on the sentencing judge's comments on mandatory application of the guidelines.
We agreed on the grouping argument, it would have to go back down for resentencing anyway. That is to say, if this court were to agree that grouping means both the offense of conviction and the would-be relevant conduct offense must be grouped, then that would require resentencing, because we'd have to recalculate the guidelines. Because the guidelines were calculated at 43, which is life all across the board as far as the advisory guidelines go.
Well, as I understand the government's argument, which I may not, they seem to argue in the supplemental briefing that the relevant conduct for grouping purposes was the second felon in possession count, and then you went into the guidelines further, and there was a reference to use the murder because that was related to that. So they more tangentially get to where the district court and I think the PSR came out originally. Do you have anything you want to say about that?
That's the same approach that probation took in the PSR. It's the same approach the government argued to the district court. It would effectively read out relevant conduct altogether, because any firearm possession is going to result in some harm. Anything you ever do with a gun, if the relevant conduct to be grouped is the subsequent possession, you'd need no definition of relevant conduct at all. No court has ever held that I'm aware of. I think the 11th Circuit expressly rejected that concept in Williams. Even the 5th Circuit, who is quoted for Gonzalez to say that they don't require relevant conduct at all, that decision was they don't require relevant conduct, presuming it was the same firearm as the offense. So though that decision sounds bad, it's actually, in Mr. Horton's case, it would result in a rule in his favor. So the thing that they must both be, any subsequent possession counts as the groupable offense or the would-be relevant conduct from which a subsequent harm flows, is very antithetical to the notion of actually relevant conduct. It would skirt around any analysis, any of the customary analyses of 1B1.3.
What would happen if we just assume for current purposes that the, I can't remember the numbers, the second guideline application, the one that was applied, was correct in this case? I understand that you would argue in that event that the course of conduct was not met in this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Go ahead and you can make your answer.
Thank you, Judge. This is not a common scheme or plan in this case. And none of the decisions cited for this proposition, including the two Third Circuit decisions, Jansen and Kulik, all of them, and the ones they collect in that footnote 4, were reversing the district court, whether by saying A2 didn't apply or whether by saying it was not part of a common scheme for the same reasons and under the same analysis that other courts said A2 didn't apply.
Well,
here on the facts,
it's not a common scheme or plan. There's another catchphrase in there.
Same course of conduct.
Same course of conduct. Tell us about that.
We're still dealing with the analyses of degree of similarity of the offenses, the regularity or repetitions of the offenses, and the interval, the time interval between the offenses. The degree of similarity, they're not similar. In this case, a guy shoots a gun into his girlfriend's car to show off and let her know he's in charge and he's the boss. He had just got out of prison. He had been serving a multi-year sentence for other violent conduct in state court. And so he shot into her car. A week later, with a different firearm, different type of firearm, for different motives, this is to say pecuniary motives, to obtain drugs, guns, and what was alleged to be a gang offense, he participated in a home invasion in a different part of Raleigh, a part that the witness for the government said was in a way different, way far away from Southeast Raleigh. This was up in North Raleigh. So the degree of the similarity is not that, not there. The regularity and repetition, this would just be the second occurrence. I don't think that doesn't even begin to build a pattern of regularity or repetitiousness. It is the second time, assuming that we were to count both of those and consider them, it would just be time number two. So there is no regularity. It just happened again. The time interval between the offenses, I don't know that there's a good argument either way with this. If they were similar and it was part of the same, and it was regularly going on, a week is not that big of a deal, and the courts found much longer units of time would apply as well. And we don't, by the way, we don't abandon the motion to abuse of discretion in denying the motion for substitute counsel.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Forehand. You've got some rebuttal time left. Ms. Fritz.
May it please the court. My name is Christine Fritz, and I represent the United States of America in this case. This case is about a very dangerous young man who willingly arms himself with illegally modified weapons, who shoots when it suits him, and who should be held accountable for the direct consequences of his actions. The district court identified a pattern. The defendant shot his girlfriend's car with a sawed-off firearm. 1 week later, he shot and killed a human being with a sawed-off firearm. The court saw that there was a pattern of behavior, properly applied the cross-reference, and held the defendant accountable for the harms that he caused. Now, I would like to briefly address the new trial Brady issue before discussing the sentencing matters. As best I understand opposing counsel's argument, his concern was that he was unable to impeach the government witnesses with the fact that there was an investigation ongoing into his client for a homicide. That fact was known well before trial. There was nothing suppressed by the government. In fact, the district court made a factual finding that around the same time of the incident with the defendant's girlfriend, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms agent Michael Finelli was conducting an investigation to determine if Horton had been involved in a certain carjacking and homicide. And that's on page 82 in the record. And then, prior to the first trial, defense counsel sought to prohibit any reference to the existence of state or federal charges, as well as any detail surrounding those charges. And the defendant renewed that motion in limine prior to the second trial. Defense counsel did not want in and before the jury the fact that his client was being investigated for a homicide. And I think that this strategic decision is very well highlighted by the paragraph on page 448 and 449 of the JA. In the second trial, there's an impeachment, or the cross-examination of Agent Finelli. The question was, originally, this was a state court investigation, and then eventually the feds took it over. Is that right? The answer was, that's a complicated answer. I was investigating Mr. Horton for other matters when this event took place. Then, at sidebar, shortly after this, the attorney said, I object to him getting into the other matter that he just indicated. I don't think that's appropriate. I asked him about this investigation, the investigation pertaining to Ms. Bryant, and he brought up the other investigation. The fact of Mr. Horton being a suspect was known all along. And I also would point the court to the fact that nowhere, I scoured the record, and nowhere in that record did either officer say Mr. Horton was not a homicide suspect. That is not in the record, because that's not what they said. They said that this investigation, which apparently, by the way this developed, this investigation refers to the investigation into the August 10th incident. They said this investigation was not a homicide investigation. That's an absolutely correct statement. And with respect to the reasons for not recording this interview, they're consistent. In the first trial, Finelli testified around 240, 241, that it was not ATF policy to video record. He wasn't sure whether there were recording devices in the room. That's pretty much consistent with what he says the second time. Around 442, he says, Horton wanted to speak about the gun from the girlfriend's house. ATF agent Finelli was not considering taping because ATF, they just really didn't record investigations. He acknowledged that he now knew that there were video recording capabilities in that room, but it didn't cross his mind. It also bears noting, Mr. Nichols said he wouldn't typically record interviews unless it was involving a homicide, which is now required by law. There was no law in place at the time of this interview. Both officers consistently testified that Horton immediately wanted to speak only about the firearm at the girlfriend's house.
Ms. Fritz, if it's okay, if we could move to the sentencing issue.
Absolutely.
If you've said everything you wanted to say about
Do
I understand that without regard to the cross-reference, the top of Mr. Horton's guideline range is about 28 years? Is that about right, give or take?
About, yes, because okay. It would be an offense level 34 criminal in the highest criminal history category.
Okay. And he still faces a mandatory, he faces a maximum of life.
He faces a maximum
of
life.
He's an ACC.
And a mandatory minimum of 15 years.
15,
yes.
Okay, all right.
Now,
what's your best argument for affirming the sentence?
Well, turning to the cross-reference, the court properly applied this cross-reference. In Pauley, the court considered the relevant conduct definition that we're looking at here, the A2 definition, which...
didn't say much about it.
Actually, respectfully, Your Honor, it did discuss that definition for about a page. On page 258, the court recognized that under the guidelines, whether a cross-reference applies depends on relevant conduct. The court went on to say, in this particular case, the district court found that the murders were relevant conduct under subsection A2. That's the subsection we have here. It goes on to explain what A2 says. So the threshold issue that the Pauley court grappled with was, did the court pick the right relevant conduct section? And can we move forward from there? And the court said, okay, we look at the grouping guidelines, and we know that drug offenses are grouped. That's met. They're drug offenses. And then, after determining that there were two groupable drug offenses before the court, it went on to evaluate the course of conduct analysis. And that is why applying this section consistent with Polly, it doesn't eliminate relevant conduct from the guidelines. Under the defendant's interpretation, under A2, it would never be possible to cross-reference a violent offense. I'm not aware of anything in this court saying that. And that doesn't seem consistent with
I'm not sure I follow that. What?
Under A2, he's saying that the cross-reference defense, the offense that you ultimately get to, must be a groupable offense. Under the grouping guidelines, violent offenses, as a general matter, with the exception of certain, I think, lower-level assaults, violent offenses are not groupable. So under A2, it would never be possible to cross-reference to such an offense.
And there are a number of circuits that seem to have taken that position.
Yes, there are circuits that have taken that position, but that position is inconsistent with Pauling.
And none that has taken the opposite position, is there?
I would disagree. I believe that in Kulik, the Third Circuit conducted an analysis very similar to that which was done in Pauly.
And a subsequent Third Circuit panel raised serious questions about the correctness of that, yes?
I don't believe so. Kulik was the 2010 case. They indicated that the groupable offenses that they looked at in that case were the firearm offenses. And they said, and they looked to Jansen, which is maybe the case that you're referring to, in saying, okay, groupable offenses are these firearm offenses. We've got that. Now, let's go to the next part of the definition. Is this a common scheme or plan, or is this a course of conduct? And that's where the Third Circuit said no. No, this wasn't a course of conduct or a common scheme or plan, and that's why it's not relevant conduct in Kulik. The court pointed out that the circumstances were different, that 27 months had elapsed between the two instances of the known firearm possession, and they said, no, that's just too much. And under Polly, I think the result would be the same in the Fourth Circuit.
What happens if we, just for purposes of discussion, disagreed that Polly was authoritative and determined that the majority of the circuits were correct? Wouldn't this have to go back?
Yes. If you determine that that is not the proper reading of the guideline, it would need to go back, because then under A2, under no circumstances ever would it be possible to cross-reference to homicide, because it's not groupable with any offense.
You know, in the other circuits that have adopted the position that is contrary to the Third Circuit, did the Department of Justice seek certiorari in any of those cases?
I'm not aware of that. I know that the Fifth Circuit has permitted the cross-reference to offenses that aren't groupable under A2, but I am not aware of there being any sort of efforts to have a higher level review.
Well, I mean, it just seems, I don't know, it has any particular meaning in this case, but it seems odd that with the policy implications and as many circuits that have adopted that view, that would be something the Justice Department would carefully think about raising in the Supreme Court if they thought it was that wrong, or the Sentencing Commission would have, or the Congress would have taken action to make the sentencing guides clearer. But that's kind of neither here nor there, I guess. Tell us about, let's just assume that A2 applies. Why is this common course of conduct, common plan, common scheme?
It's the same course of conduct, and the court This court has said in United States versus Mullins and also Hodge that you look to whether there's an identifiable pattern of some sort of criminal behavior. The circumstances that you consider are the degree of similarity, the regularity or repetitions, the time interval between the offenses. And they go on to say that if you have a strong presence of one of these, even if there is not one present, if you have a stronger presence of another factor, you can still find that there's a course of conduct.
What is your strongest factor for course of conduct in your view?
I think that the temporal proximity is very relevant, and it's very strong. We have 7 days elapsing between his possession of these two firearms. I also think that the nature of the firearms is very compelling. Although the first one was a rifle and the second one was a shotgun, it's undisputed that both were sawed down. They were illegally modified. These were guns that, as far as I know, even if he weren't a felon, you still couldn't legally possess.
Would you make the same argument if they were two pistols?
I don't think that that would be as compelling a factor if they were two pistols. I think the fact that...
What if they were both automatics? I'm trying to find the line you're trying to draw.
The line that I'm trying to draw, I suppose, is that when you have a sawed-off long gun, that long gun, and it's sawed off in this manner, that gun itself is illegal to possess. And there's testimony in the record that generally, when individuals have these firearms, especially individuals who have been in the criminal element, that it's so that you can more easily conceal these firearms. You don't have a sawed-off shotgun as a general matter just because. You know.
So your answer to Judge Thacker is 1 week temporal nexus and nature of the weapon.
Yes, and I think there are some other factors. Obviously, these were willful possessions, and he was very willing to use those guns. That's a circumstance, the ease with which he would discharge the firearm. He grew angry with his girlfriend, so he goes outside and he shoots her car. He encounters resistance in a robbery, so he shoots the person. This isn't a situation where there was just a gun sitting in the house. This was an individual.
There'll be, this weekend here, there'll be, unfortunately, any number of incidents where domestic partners will have a spat and somebody's going to fire a weapon. That's going to be fairly frequent in the Richmond metropolitan area this weekend. But there are probably going to be very few home invasions. There seems to be a little dissimilarity between those two acts.
Well, I think another factor that helps to tie things together as well is the inference that those firearms were going to be used for criminal purposes, which you draw in part from the nature of the firearm itself, but then also the fact that his possession of both firearms did appear to be gang-related. The first firearm, he admitted that he was holding for his big homie in the Bloods gang. And this individual, as we know from the record, was subject to many federal investigations and was himself a felon and was later indicted and is in prison. And the second, and also there's the fact that it was going to be very difficult for the defendant to explain to Tech that the gun was with the police. You can certainly infer that there was a gang connection there. And then there's no question that the second instance, the home invasion robbery, was similarly gang-related. These were all Bloods, 9-Trey Bloods, who went into this home at the direction of a fellow gang member. So that's another factor. And all of these circumstances are what was before the court, and the court ultimately weighed those circumstances and decided that there was a sufficient connection between the two instances to warrant the cross-reference.
So what's our standard of review in determining the facts in the record fitting the guideline definition of course of conduct?
The facts would obviously be reviewed for clear error. The district court's analysis It would seem that it would be an abuse of discretion unless this court is in a position to find as a matter of law that it was not possible for the court to reach that conclusion on these facts, because the court was engaging in a weighing test. And it would seem that there would be some deference given to the district court's evaluation of how heavily the different factors would weigh. Now, and I think that although the defendant does challenge the evidence supporting the district court's conclusion that he was involved in a homicide, the standard before the district court was a preponderance of the evidence. Detective Copeland was on the stand for a considerable amount of time, and he testified about the extensive investigation the Raleigh Police Department conducted, that this wasn't a rush to judgment, that they followed up different leads, and that all of that investigation led them to the conclusion that this defendant was the shooter. And although the district court didn't make extensive findings of facts according to the defendant, the district court did say, I think the government has it right. I think probation's got it right. The court adopted the PSR without change. And the court also, in stating its reasons, specified that this defendant, 7 days after possessing the firearm at the girlfriend's house, went in to a residence, participated in a home invasion, and shot somebody. So under all of the circumstances, we argue that the district court did properly utilize that cross-reference, that the groupable offenses that are at issue are the instances of firearm possession, that this was a pattern, and that there was more than sufficient evidence to conclude that the defendant shot Charmika Harris and killed her. And the district court, in imposing its sentence, held the defendant accountable for that. Are there any further questions?
Is the state case being held by agreement of the parties?
I learned that.
I imagine there's some speedy trial issues floating around.
I did follow up on that. My understanding is that the state murder case was dismissed once there was a life sentence imposed in this case. However, it was dismissed without prejudice, and it could be reinstated, and the court and the state, under the appropriate circumstances, would pursue that case.
Okay. And I have one more question. I'm curious how your colleague failed to alert the court to the fact that the guidelines are not mandatory, even at offense level 43.
Well, I think that the district court did repeatedly say, he references the advisory guidelines range. And there was a significant argument about whether or not this defendant.
But didn't he say on the record that it was mandatory? Or was that only in his written order?
If I may?
Yes.
He did make the reference that it was mandatory, but that was bookended with various statements that it was advisory.
If you had been there, you would have jumped up and said, oh, no, Your Honor, no, Your Honor. there are no longer any mandatories.
Were I in that position, I think that I would have asked afterwards to make clear for the record, just in case there's any issue, that this was a sentence imposed according to his discretion.
Okay.
We ask that you affirm.
Thank you very much. Mr. Forehand, you have some rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. It's the case that the court was just asking about, the state case. It's not in the record. I happen to know because my office is right beside the lawyer who represents Mr. Horton in the state case. There were speedy trial motions filed, and whatever that means, that's what it means. I do want to hammer a little bit on the factual standard here, and for the if presuming that this court does apply A2, and presuming that it could have been relevant conduct, because even if it could have been a part of a common scheme or plan or course, the facts here don't show that. There was no credibility analysis here. And I did handle the sentencing hearing. I stepped in between right before sentencing. The witnesses that testified were summarizing a police, hundreds of, eight, maybe 800 pages of police reports. I had gotten about 200 pages of them. They were summarizing what other officers had done. They, and the record shows this in the joint appendix here, for most of the questions that we asked about exculpatory evidence, the answer was, I don't know. I'm not familiar with that part of it. So the district court did not conduct a credibility analysis like we think of when we talk about giving deference and great weight to the to those things that are uniquely within the province of the trial courts. It was two witnesses who weren't even testifying to things. Most of the things they said were not things that they had seen or heard or observed. And as far as the analysis goes, I think what that's the statement that, that counsel just said, probation got it right. That wasn't just a summary. That was the analysis. That's all we have in the record about what the district court found as far as the credibility goes with the facts of the cross-reference. We would also go back to the statement regarding the motion for a new trial. Even if we wouldn't have used the materials, which I contend we would have, if the homicide was so obvious and it was so plain and everyone should have known it, didn't the government, and I'll just phrase that instead of an interrogatory, the government did have an obligation to tell the court that this testimony it was receiving from the witnesses the government called was very different from their prior testimony under oath, particularly at the motion to suppress hearing.
I think you're clear that Pauley does not control the result here.
Yes, sir. We're clear on that. And I would say even none of the cases that we've cited this morning, in every one of them, the appellate court vacated the criminal judgment and sent it back down and said you cannot do the enhancement you were trying to do, however you get there. Even in Jansen, and if I were Mr. Kulik's lawyer, I might would have wanted to argue to the panel that the Jansen court, by saying A2 applied, what they were actually doing was applying a more limited definition of relevant conduct than what the government was urging. Jansen was an appeal from a district court's denial of a 2255 motion based on ineffective assistance of counsel, where the guy had got a long sentence for purchasing a bunch of drugs at once, some of which he was going to sell, some of which he said was for his personal use. Lawyer did not argue at sentencing that the court should not count the personal use part. And so on the appeal from the denial of the 2255 motion, the government said, well, A1 means any act you committed during the course of the offense was possession with intent to distribute. You committed the act of simple possession for your own personal consumption during that time period, so it must be relevant conduct. And they relied on the dissent in Fraser, which I think was a Second Circuit decision, to say that that was okay, that's relevant conduct. And the Third Circuit and Jansen stepped in and say, no, we can't, we're not going to read A1 so broadly as though we don't think A2 exists. A2's there for a reason. It's got to be, even this broader A2, it's got to be part of a common scheme or plan or the same course of conduct. And of course this wasn't. So the Jansen decision, the analysis there, would help Mr. Horton. And the reason that the Jansen court stated for the reason it would apply A2 to that case was that drugs are not unique identifiable units of offenses, that they are quantifiable. Even though they said it wasn't relevant, drugs for sale and drugs for possession are equally quantifiable under the guidelines. So they said grouping could work for that. By contrast, when you're talking about a felon in possession conviction and cross-referencing violent crime like murder, that is always going to be distinct identifiable harm. And yes, we do argue that 1B1.3A2 can never be used to cross-reference murder. Never. That doesn't mean it can't be used for relevant conduct. You've got A1. You've got for the defendant's own acts that occurred during the commission of the offense. You've got A3 for harms that result therefrom. And you have A4, which says unless the guideline says you're supposed to consider something else. And here, the guideline for being a felon in possession, I'll finish this sentence and I'll be done. The guideline for felon in possession does not say that. So all we have is relevant conduct. For that reason, we request the court vacate the conviction and alternatively vacate the sentence.
Mr. Forehand, we thank you for your argument. We note that you're court appointed and we want to express the court's appreciation for your agreeing to undertake that service and hope you will continue to do so in the future.
Thank you, Judge.
We will come down and greet counsel